waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad, host of the People Speak radio show. Here at the People Speak, we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. Tonight, our guest is an amazing man that has graced our show in the past and is a loved musician all over the world. Pete Seeger is a folk singer, a political activist, an author. We all remember Where Have All the Flowers Gone, If I Had a Hammer, Turn, Turn, Turn. Well, this is the man that's saying, hello, Pete. How are you? Welcome to our show.
Well, hello. It's interesting to be on your radio program. Are you on the air once a week or once a day or when?
Well, I'll tell you what, Pete. We always are on Tuesday night at 8 Eastern time, but we do occasionally have special shows that we do. Such as Archbishop Desmond Tutu. We had to accommodate the time changes. And then since we do interviews from all over the world, obviously sometimes we have to accommodate, so we will switch it. But our regular show is always on Tuesday night at 8 Eastern. That's the People Speak radio show.
And do people listen to it all over the country or mainly in California?
We have a listening audience all over the world. We also go through Paltalk, then they have over 4 million active users. So, Pete, excuse me, who are you endorsing in this election? That's one of the big questions.
Well,
we're not letting anybody off the hook on that one. We're only asking everybody on this.
Keeping my mind open to hear what goes on within the next few months. I will probably vote for one of the Democrats, but who knows? If they pick a really good man, I might vote for a Republican. I'm serious, because you know there are some very interesting Republicans. Did you ever hear of Gordon K. Durnell?
Durnell.
He was appointed
I've heard the name, but I honestly, I'd be lying if I told you I knew a lot about him. Is this someone that you're hoping will push his hat in?
I'd like to see him speaking up. 15 years ago, he wrote a book called The Making of a Conservative Environmentalist. And the first President Bush had appointed him to be chairman of the Great Lakes Commission. And there he made a good decision. He said, why don't we make our decisions by consensus? If we cannot agree, neither Canada nor USA will pay any attention to us. I don't want to waste my time. Well, you bet they had longer meetings and more of them. At the end of 4 terms, when his term of office was up, he put out this book, The Making of a Conservative Environmentalist. He's still conservative in more ways than one, I believe, although I haven't double-checked. But he says, we know that chlorine is killing nature, and it's killing us. It should be banned from the world, just like smallpox. The chlorine industry will holler bloody murder. They're a multi-billion-dollar industry, but they'll find other things they can sell for bleaching and for getting rid of bacteria. And when we finally get rid of smallpox, even if it takes 50 years, the whole world will be better off. Well, that's the kind of decision which I'd like to see made by somebody in the White House, where the whole world would be better
Pete,
off.
You did start an environmental program called Clearwater. Can you tell us a little bit about Clearwater?
Well, I was 40 years old when I had a job on Cape Cod, and somebody showed me what fun it was to sail. Now I know why millionaires spend a lot of money for yachts to sail in. It's a game with infinity. It's a game with the wind and the waves, and you try and outguess them, and you go back and forth, and sometimes the wind can be blowing from the north, but if you slant your sails right, you can sail northwest, and then you turn and sail northeast, and then you turn again and sail northwest. you can use the very power of the wind against you to sail into the wind. Now, that's good politics, too. Dr. King would make a speech somewhere and get thrown in jail, and he'd get publicity. Next thing, more contributions would come in. And I started to learn to sail on the Hudson River. I bought a little plastic boat. I'd started earning enough money. I think it cost $1,000. And took my family out sailing. And then I noticed what I was sailing through, lumps of this and that along with the toilet paper. I thought of a phrase which John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, used, private affluence, public squalor. There I had enough money to buy a little boat, but I was sailing through toilet waste. Just about that time, a friend of mine said, Pete, you know they used to have big sailboats on the river, like 100 feet tall. And I said, oh, they didn't have sailboats that big. Only an American Cup race was that big, or maybe ocean-going boats. He says, no, these were river boats, sloops, one mast. Well, he gave me a book called Sloops of the Hudson. It was written, actually, in 1907, 100 years ago now, but this was in way back in the 40s, was it? Yes. Around 45, he loaned me this book. And it was written by two men. One of them was from my hometown of Beacon, New York, 60 miles north of the big city. And he said, these were the most beautiful boats, and they'll never be seen again. There was one chapter on ghost stories, how the captain anchored because the wind had given out and the tide was against him. You know, the tide goes up and down. Every 6 hours it changes. So the captain anchored, and he couldn't make the last few hundred yards to where he wanted to dock. But in the middle of the night, the tide changes, and he hears bump, bump, bump. He says, oh, my boat is bumping into something. He ran up and found his boat bumping against the very dock he tried to make the day before and had not been able to make. He said, my boat knew where she was supposed to go. There were some accidents because some places the Hudson is quite narrow. It's only 400 feet wide at West Point. And the Dutch called it the water gut, meaning the weather hole. And the wind can come down from a mountain, and you don't see the ripples on the water, and all of a sudden it hits you, and you don't know what's happening. And there have been many a wreck there. They have sometimes what they call an unexpected jibe. The jibe is when the wind blows the big boom with the sail all across from one side to the other. And if it happens when you're not expecting it, you can get hurt. And down near West Point, one man was at the tiller, and the great big rope looped around his neck and took his head off and landed in the water 30 feet away while his body collapsed on deck. So it could be dangerous, even though it was just a river. One ocean-going captain was teasing a river pilot. He said, what would you do if you were 1,000 mile out and it was blowing force 10, that is 100 miles an hour? I bet you'd be scared out of your pants. And the river captain said, I suppose I would be, just as you would be if you were on the river and it was blowing force 10 and you were only 100 yards from the rocks. So
let me ask you, please. Oh, go right ahead. I'm sorry.
Let me just finish this little story. Anyway, I said to my friend, why don't we build a replica of a Hudson River sloop? They built a replica of the Mayflower up at Plymouth, Massachusetts. We ought to build a replica of a Hudson River sloop and remind people what a beautiful river this is. And 3 years later, believe it or not, we had raised enough money to get the boat built. And that was some 38 years ago, and we learned how to pay for it by taking school children out, and we learned how to teach them on the deck a little bit about sailing, a little bit about cleaning up pollution, a little about history. We've taken over 400,000 school kids out on sails, and
wow.
The river is now halfway clean. We are a long ways to go still, but it's halfway clean. We're swimming in it. In fact, two days ago, we had a swim across the Hudson, 1 mile up where I live, and 200 people swam across.
Isn't that amazing? Pete, how do you differ? When does the point come from storytelling to music making or music writing? You tell a story so beautifully. You really do. And as you were talking just now, I just, you know, kept seeing these scenes that you're describing so eloquently. And I know you've written thousands of songs. When does the story become the song, or the song become the story in your mind? And pushes you to create a song from a story?
Well, I keep reminding people that long, long time ago, there was no such thing as radio, no such thing as television, no such thing as recordings. And people used to sing and tell stories to each other. And maybe old grandma could remember some stories which the grandchildren would like. Or maybe a neighbor comes over and he was good at telling funny stories. And they'd sit around the fire. If it was cold weather, they got as close to the open fire as they could. Or if they were rich, maybe they had a stove. But they'd tell stories and sing songs. And often these songs were political, because they'd make up a song to support something that's going on, or opposing something that's going on. You know, way, way back, the year was 1840. There was a young man living in a town along the Hudson, and he knew that some of the farmers around him had farmed their land for 150 years, but it wasn't their land. It was owned by a landlord, and they had to pay rent. And the farmers wanted to own their own land. And he started an organization. They called themselves the Calico Indians. They harked back to the Boston Tea Party. And when the sheriff came to evict some farmer for not paying his rent, they would tar and feather the sheriff. Well, one of these sheriffs got killed, and they made up a song. The moon was shining silver bright. Sheriff came in the dead of night. Oh, let me get the banjo, because this is really a banjo tune.
We absolutely have to have banjo. Oh, my God.
The song was Old Dan Tucker. That was the original name. It was the hit song of 1948. Get out the way, Old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get your supper. Well, they made up new words. Get out the way, Big Bill Snyder, we'll tar your coat and feather your hide, sir. The moon was shining silver bright, the sheriff came in the dead of night. High on a hill, an Indian stood, and the tin horn sounded through the wood. Get out the way, Big Bill Snyder, we'll tar your coat and feather your hide, sir. A fellow wrote a whole book about, he called it Tin Horns and Calico, because they would meet at night to the sound of the long tin dinner horn, a tube about 4 feet long, and they were used during the daytime by the women to call the men in from the fields for dinner. And now they blew it at night to call the farmers together to have a meeting and decide what their next tactic would be. Well, it started, as I say, in 1844, and then some people got killed, and then people got thrown in jail, and it looked like they had failed. But because they'd put up a struggle, they got some publicity. I got a slogan, the price of liberty is eternal publicity. Anyway.
Excellent.
Anyway, the next governor was elected with a promise to change the New York State a constitution to force the breakup of the bigger states. One man, Stephen Van Rensselaer III, had 2 million acres of land, and 60,000 farmers had to bow down when his carriage passed and pay him rent every month, every year. Well, the people in the cities read about it in the newspapers and said, that doesn't seem right. They've been farming that land for 150 years, and they still can't own their land. So they did change the New York State law to force the breakup of the big estates. And they were called the down-rent laws. The down-rent war.
The Irish story is so important to you.
Their newspaper in Albany, and he put a song in every issue. The Irish love to sing.
Why are these stories so important to you, Pete?
Well, I think I'd rather tell a story than make a speech. Tell the story and let people make up their own mind about it. And there are now all sorts of wonderful stories going on. Do you know in New York City they have 800 community gardens and an umbrella organization called the Green Gorillas that shows them how to work with the park department so their garden doesn't get bulldozed. It usually starts with a few women and children planting some flowers, and then some men come along and join them and plant some vegetables. And now people say, oh, I want an apartment looking out on that beautiful garden. If they don't watch out, the whole neighborhood starts to get gentrified, and now a developer says, hey, I can make some money there. Get rid of that garden. I'll put up a high-rise. But if they work with the park department, they get a name, they get a number, and maybe a fence, and they can't be bulldozed so easily.
Isn't it amazing? Bulldozers are an incredible tool in politics these days in many ways. You're not a newbie to the world of politics, Pete. In 1955, the Committee House on Un-American Activities, you responded to some of the questions, and one of your answers, you said, I never did anything conspiratorial, that there were times when an American should not be asked certain questions.
Well, those were back in the days of the Cold War, and I felt that people had a right to their own opinion, whether they're opinions of the right or the left or the upside down or what. Back in my youth, I was actually a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, and I think now the big mistake was communists and socialists and liberals and anarchists and all kinds were not willing to talk with each other. I'm convinced that if there's a human race here in 100 years, we'll learn how to talk with people we deeply disagree with, or even slightly disagree with. But I think atheists and church people should talk together, and different kinds of church people should talk together. And who knows, if we can learn to talk together, maybe we'll not blow this world up. On the other hand, God only knows what the future will be, and all we can do is try and do our best.
Well, you seem to have a knack with talking with people, even if you don't disagree. And reading the transcripts during that that hearing, I was astounded by your method of responding to questions that were obviously belligerent, obviously trying to get you to commit to saying something. And you were so calm. You were so collected. How do you do that?
Well, I guess I've always been able to strum an instrument and have people looking at me without getting nervous. And I guess people could ask me questions and I'd not get nervous either. I did, if you remember, say, you've got a right to your opinion, I got a right to my opinion. And I've never refused to sing for anybody, no matter who their opinion. Whereas I said, I've sung for the Rockefellers and I've sung for all kinds of people.
Exactly, and that's what you stated that time, that one of the things that if you were going to be accused of anything, you had never not sang to a particular group of people. You just sang for everybody.
Story. About 1 month after that questioning, I was asked to sing down in Louisiana, in the part of Louisiana where they speak a kind of French they call Cajun, because their ancestors hundreds of years ago came from Nova Scotia, which was called Acadia. So they were Acadians, and the slang grew to be called Cajuns. Well, I went down there, and the woman in charge of the festival said, oh, tonight we're going to have a little party, and you'll get a chance to hear some of our music. And that evening, they went to, there was a nice middle-class ranch house, and they opened the door and said, Mr. Seeger, meet Congressman Willis. Well, Congressman Willis had been one of the committee questioning me only a month earlier. We both did a double take, but he didn't say anything. I went in, and they said, Pete, get your banjo out. Let's have some music. So I started getting people singing along, and there was Willis sitting in the corner of his living room, and I was enjoying myself singing. He finally beckoned with a crooked finger toward me, come. And I got up from my seat and followed him into the kitchen. He said, well, Mr. Seeger, it's a small world. How did you get here? Who invited you? I said, well, the Chamber of Commerce is putting on a festival here, and I was invited down. Well, we'll see about it. The next day, the man at the Chamber of Commerce says, oh, this is ridiculous. Let me bump heads with Willis. But Willis had a harder head than he had. He was married to the daughter of the owner of the local sugar mill. And if he'd allowed me to sing in his hometown without making a big fuss about it, he would have been very embarrassed. So I bid the good people farewell, and I flew out to California, where I was going to sing the following few days anyway. Oh, me.
Well, I think that a couple of things here. You know, there's a drive right now that wants to see you nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize in 2008. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a little embarrassed. I think there have been lots of heroic people that no one ever heard of. All I did was sing songs and have the right to sing songs, thanks to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And a long tradition in America that you got a right to speak your mind. It's a wonderful tradition. And I don't expect, you know, there's thousands of people are nominated for Nobel Prizes, I guess. But I feel there's completely unknown people who often do truly heroic things. It might be some woman who's kept a family together in spite of hard times, and all the kids have grown up to be really worthwhile kids. None of them get into drugs. And somebody like that deserves a Nobel Prize.
What about, you know, you're absolutely right. Some of the Nobel Prize winners that we have interviewed on our show have been the most refreshing, ordinary, wonderful human beings. I can't even begin to tell you how pleasant it was to just talk with them and see what a simple movement. You know, you said all I did was sing songs. Well, one of our Nobel Peace Prize winners, all she did was.
All she did was what? We got cut off. Oh, dear. What did we do to get cut off?
apologize for the technical difficulties, and we're back. Thank you, Pete, for being so patient with us this evening. I think some of the storms around here are causing some problems. I was saying that you said all I do was sing songs. Do you really think that that's a minimalistic way of looking at the incredible contribution you have given to the world?
Well, I sang many different kinds of songs, but I tried to sing songs that were not so complicated that other people could not sing them too, or at least join in on the chorus. And I started making up songs because I had a family and I had children. I started making up songs and telling stories to them. My big job the last few years is to put out a songbook of the songs I've written all my life. And I'd put it out 15 years ago, but there were so many mistakes in it, I told the little publisher, don't reprint it. I want to correct it. And so finally, the corrected, revised issue is going to press. It's called Where Have All the Flowers Gone? A Sing-Along Memoir. Are we still connected?
Yes, we are. We're right here.
Good.
You know, that happens to be one of my favorite all. You know, I'm one of those old-time hippie flower children, hug a tree as you go by. Never, you know, as a matter of fact, my daughter asked me one time whenever I would take a picture, she goes, why do you always have to hug a tree? So for me, Where Have All the Flowers Gone is just an incredible song. And this is it right here. These are sing-along tunes. And I think that's probably the engaging quality of a lot of your music is that they are sing-along tunes, and people love that. It brings people together. They sit around, like you said, campfires, or they sit around a piano, or they sit around with family reunions, and they sing your music.
Yeah. Well, I come from a musical family. My father and my mother were both music teachers. And my younger half-brother, Mike, is the best guitarist and fiddler and banjo picker in the family. Come to think of it, he plays a mandolin, too, and also a wonderful little collection of pipes, like a pan pipes you whistle on. He lives down in Virginia. We don't see each other, but every year or so, Michael Seeger is his name, and all his younger sister is the best ballad singer in the whole family, Peggy Seeger. She lived over in England for a while, was married to a Scottish singer, a Scot singer named Ewan McCall. And when he first met her, he wrote a song for her, which became well known over here, The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face. So the whole family likes music. Now, are we still connected? I think we've been cut off again.
Thank you.
again?
Yes, we are, sir, and how wonderful. You were talking to me about your brother and what an incredible musician he was. Have you guys ever done any songs together?
Oh, occasionally we get together. I can't remember exactly. I think we both worked for an astonishingly small record company that didn't sell many records, but they let us do anything we want. way back in the year of 1939, a man named Moses Ash lived in New York, and his father was a famous writer, Sholem Ash. He wrote books, Joseph and His Brothers, and so on. And his father, in early 1939, said, "Mo, you've bought a recording machine. Will it fit in the trunk of my car?" And Mo says, "Yes, I guess so. Why?" He says, "We've got to drive to Princeton, New Jersey, and get Dr. Einstein to record a short message, maybe 2 minutes, which can be played on the radio in New York and other cities, urging American Jews not to waste a minute to get their relatives out of Germany." Well, they drove to Princeton, they recorded the short message, then over supper, Dr. Einstein said, "Young Mr. Ash, are you a writer like your father?" "Oh, no," says Mo, "I make a living installing public address systems in hotels, but I made enough money to buy this recording machine, and I'm fascinated with what it can do. I've met in New York a great Negro folk singer named Leadbelly, but nobody's recording him because they say he's not commercial. But I say this is American culture. It should be recorded. He's recorded for the Library of Congress, but you have to go down to Washington to hear the record." Einstein said, "You're absolutely right. Americans don't appreciate their own culture. It'll be a Polish Jew like you who will do the job." So he recorded Leadbelly. Years later, I asked him, "How many copies did you sell?" He said, 100 copies the first year. However, a few years later, they invented LP records, and now he could ship a record very inexpensively. Just put it between a couple pieces of cardboard, put the stamps on it. Before, you, to mail a shellac record, you had to pack them in about 3 inches of padding to keep them from breaking. But now he was in business, and he recorded 2,000 titles in the next 40 years. And when he died, he got his family to promise, "Don't sell my record company to people who will just release the good-selling records. They have to tell them they have to release all of them or none of them." And that's what they did. They found out the Smithsonian Institution in Washington would release every single one. My nephew, Dr. Anthony Seeger, who's an ethnomusicologist, he was laughing. He said, "Some of these records may only sell 5 copies a year. But when they've sold those 5, we make 5 new ones, CDs now, and Xerox or photocopy 5 more copies of the little brochure that tells about the music, and it's still available."
Isn't that amazing? Do you still see a lot of your old friends, some of your old singing partners, people that you've you really admired and maybe did work together with at the time, Pete?
Well, once in a long while we get together, but Lee Hayes, the man who wrote the words for If I Had a Hammer, died about 27 years ago, 26 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was a real genius. Woody Guthrie died way back in 1957.
Yeah.
He had inherited a disease from his mother called, Huntington's disease. And there was no cure for it. Oh, let me tell you about Lee Hayes, though. He was the son of a Methodist preacher in Arkansas, and he'd been working at a little school which tried to be an interracial school, and the Ku Klux Klan got after them. They practically burnt the school down, and Lee had to flee from Arkansas to keep from getting lynched himself. He came to New York and lived in Brooklyn for a while and in Manhattan for a while, then moved up to the little town of Croton, 28 miles north, And I visited him. He drank too much beer. He got diabetes. But he wrote a poem, which I've wanted to spread. I put it in my book. If I should one day die by violence, please take this as my written will. And in the name of simple common sense, treat my destroyer only as one ill. As one who needed more than I could give. As one who never really learned to live in peace and joy and love of life, but was diseased and plagued by hate and strife. My vanished life might have some meaning still when my destroyer learns to know goodwill.
That's amazing. What a brilliant, brilliant piece.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, didn't you say something when we first got on together about how your memory was going bad? It just felt like it's going bad to me.
Oh, well, I can remember things songs I learned 80 years ago, but I can't remember where I left my glasses about 20 times a day. And I'll say, Joe, I've known you 40 years, but what's your last name? I'm especially bad on names.
Pete, what are you doing with yourself these days?
Who's this person? I said, well, the name's familiar, but I can't put a face to him.
Isn't that something? What are you doing with yourself these days? I mean, what projects are you involved with? I know that just the fact that you are still advocating the impeachment, I know, of Bush and Cheney, you're calling out for their impeachment, leads me to believe and understand that you're still politically involved to a certain extent. How do you feel about this administration?
Once
what's
a week,
going on?
I and a few others stand on that side of a busy highway. There's a red light there, and cars. One is a six-lane highway, the other is a four-lane highway,
mm-hmm.
and cars pile up, 20 or 30 or 40 more cars, and then the light changes and they zoom off. Well, we stand there with signs, and some of them say, "Honk if you want peace." And we get lots of honks. One of the signs is, the president lied, people died. And one of the signs said, my dog would make a better president. But that's just for a few hours once a week. Here's one of the more interesting projects, our little Clearwater Club on the waterfront of my hometown has worked out with an architect who's designed a special kind of a swimming pool which floats in the Hudson and goes up and down with the tide, so it stays the same depth. It has netting on the bottom, and so it doesn't get too deep for children. And they've just started testing it. If it passes all its tests, by the end of the summer, we'll go ahead and put in and raise the money for a big swimming pool, which will be deeper, and adults will use it.
Isn't that amazing? We do have a caller, Pete, on line one. And for those that are interested in talking to Pete Seeger Live, all you have to do is dial in to 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494, and it's an international toll-free call. Caller, do you have a question for Pete Seeger?
This is Steve from Santa Fe, Bessemer. No, I just wanted to thank Pete. You know, Pete, you were the people, you and the people that you were with, that ended up defining a generation, and I'm part of that generation. I'm environmentally aware. I protest both environment and government, and it's all because of the people like you that have told your stories through song, and most wonderfully, that has made me who I am. I appreciate it, and I wanted to thank you, sir. And my favorite that you did was your rendition of Joe Hill. And with I'll listen to you on the web. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Tell us about, I'm not familiar with the Joe Hill piece. That must be
Joe Hill was
time.
A Swedish-American who lived 100 years ago, and the longshoremen in San Pedro, California, went on strike. The engineers running the railroad trains coming up to San Pedro had a different union, and they said, no, we're not on strike, we'll keep bringing things up. And so Joe wrote a satirical song about the scab engineers. The workers on the SB line for strike sent out a call. For Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and the driver's on the bum, and the engines and the bearing, they were all out of plumb. Casey Jones kept his junk pile running. Casey Jones was doing double time. Casey Jones became an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the SB line.
That's wonderful. How wonderful.
And then some 30 years later, a poet in New York wrote some words, and a friend of mine, Earl Robinson, put a melody to it. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. And Joan Baez and many, many other people have sung that. Paul Robeson sang it. Well,
there was a book called The Deaf Musicians. What an interesting title. And in it you wrote, poor Lee, he used to be a jazzman that could make the piano go yimba timba tang, zing zang. But now he's lost his hearing, the band leader had to let him go. Tell us about that.
Well, I made up this song for my kids once, this story. And then I forgot about the story until I meet a young writer. He was the grandson of a poet I knew, Walter Lowenfels. I made up some melodies for some of Walter's poems. But young Paul Jacobs, his grandson, Walter's daughter's son, heard that story and said, let's develop that a little bit. And before he was through, we had almost a new story about this musician, this jazz musician, who goes to school to learn what's called ASL, American Sign Language. And traveling on the subway one day, he manages to bump into another deaf person who uses sign language, and they start talking with each other. No matter how noisy the subway was, they could talk by moving their hands and fingers. Then they got talking about some of the old jazz standards they used to play, Sunny Side of the Street, Blue Skies, and so on, Over the Rainbow. And Lee was a piano player. The other man was a saxophone player, I think. Or a trumpet player, was he? At any rate, they start pretending like they're playing their instrument. And they're keeping in rhythm with each other. Their feet are tapping in rhythm with each other. And in their minds, they hear the music. People look at them and realize they're playing music with each other, even though you can't hear a thing.
Exactly.
Then along comes a woman who says, I recognize that tune. I know sign language, too. And can I play bass with you? So she pretends like she's playing a string bass with one hand high up on the neck of the standing bass and the other one plucking it. And pretty soon the three of them are having a fine time, and they arrange to take the same subway every day. And people who like to hear them try and take that same subway so they can watch these three jazz musicians playing with each other, even though there's not a sound coming. Then they say, you know what we need? A singer. And the bass player says, I know just the person. And she brings in a woman who knows these songs, and she soundlessly is singing. And there are these four musicians having a great time playing together, one jazz standard after another, and one day they meet the leader of the band that had to fire Lee because he couldn't hear it. And he once said, "Yeah, who will listen to a deaf musician?" And Lee points around at the whole crowd in the subway station. Everybody.
Everybody would, and everybody was signing at this. That's an incredible story.
Yeah. Well, sign language is an extraordinary thing. It's very simple. It's very simple, and the grammar is simple. It's not exactly like word language. You don't spell things out. You just point here and you point there, open your hand in one way or close it another way, and you can talk very fast. Somebody, a sign language translator, comes to our Clearwater festivals every June on the Hudson, and there'll be somebody singing on stage or talking on stage quite fast, and the signer is keeping right up with them, not losing a beat.
Isn't that amazing? Pete, we have a caller on the line with a question.
Okay.
Caller,
hello.
What is your name and where you're calling from and your question for Pete?
Hello, this is Richard here in the United Kingdom.
Well, well.
Hello? You got me?
What part
hello,
of
Mr.
the United
Sager.
Kingdom?
It's absolutely wonderful to talk to you. My question is that today, very sadly, the Yangtze, as in China, the Yangtze River dolphin has been pronounced officially extinct. What hope do you have
because
for the
big
rest
dam,
of nature against the with the development of industrial China and other parts of Asia and also, of course, other parts of the world?
That's tragic. Officially extinct.
I mean, I'm terribly sorry to depress you, Mr. Seeger, but it was officially announced
problem.
Today, apparently, according to
our
the BBC.
Our human race is not taking care of the Earth like we should. On the other hand, there's more people like you and me all the time. And I go along with Paul Hawken, who's just written a book called Blessed Unrest. And the subtitle is, How Did the Biggest Movement in the World Arrive So Suddenly? And nobody predicted its coming. It doesn't have a name, this movement.
Yeah.
But it's composed of people who love the earth and they love each other. They want to see peace. They want to see civil rights. And they want to see pure air and water. There's no name for this movement. If there was, maybe it could be attacked. But everybody knows they're all members of it. And we remember biologists like René Dubos, who said, think globally, act locally. Or like E.F. Schumacher, who came from the UK and said, small is beautiful. So I'm more optimistic than I was 60 years ago after Hiroshima. I think we have a much better chance.
Thank you, Mr. Sager.
Thank you, caller. Thank you very much for calling. And, you know, Pete, how do you become so optimistic? One of the things that I find in many of our interviews is that so many of these people that have struggled throughout their lives to bring some kind of a message have now actually ended up more optimistic than ever before in a time when people are feeling less optimistic in general as to what's going on in our administration and in our world. Look, we just hear about this animal that breed that is now currently considered extinct, this dolphin, this beautiful animal. You know, how do you keep up your spirits through all this?
Well, God only knows what the future is going to be. But he gave us brains, and I say if we use them, we will survive. I talk to very religious people sometimes, and I say, when you come to a curb at the edge of a street, do you look up in the sky and say, God, it's dangerous crossing the streets. Will you please see I don't get hit? No. You walk to the curb, you look to the left, you look to the right, and if there's no car coming, you cross. You use the brains God gave you. And if we use the brains God gave us, we are going to put an end to war. within the next few years. We're going to put an end to all sorts of bad things because we know we've got to work together. And that means not just saving our neighborhoods, but saving every neighborhood all around the world.
Well, it is absolutely an amazing feat. And as I said, you're an inspiration to many people. There are so many areas that you've been indoctrinated in, so many movements that you have led. What do you look back upon in your life and say, I am most proud of?
I think I'm most proud that my wife and I have stayed together for 64 years, and we're on good terms with our three children and our six grandchildren. And I feel that I've got thousands of musical grandchildren around the country, maybe tens of thousands, maybe around the world. People who said, I won't get rich, but I can sing my songs and maybe help people in some way.
And what does Toshi look back on? Does she have any regrets?
Well, like many men, I've gotten too busy myself and not paid enough attention to the things she wanted to do. She ran a very good festival for Clearwater until she got too old for it. And she was the one who started using signers, American Sign Language, for all the stages. And she started with the dance stage, too, where people just like to dance, 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 this kind of dance and that kind of dance. She got some carpenters who found a way to lay 2x4 beams of wood down on a level piece of grass and then fasten to them pieces of plywood. And so you can dance even on a good wooden floor. And next year, I think I'm going to see if we can't get more gospel singers on, because I love gospel singing. And if we get not one gospel singer singing to a bunch of white people, I want to get a whole gospel church to come. And when the chorus is singing, there'll be a whole audience of mixed white and black and Latino and Asian and Lord knows what. Incidentally, my hometown is a little bit like this. My hometown has got 14,000 people. We have one day in which it's called the Spirit of Beacon Day, and there are like 7,000 or 8,000 people on Main Street. It's a great big block party, and they are, believe it or not, from 50 different ethnic groups. We have a liberal Republican mayor who's been reelected four times, and she goes around with a list. It used to have 49 ethnic groups listed on it, and she was in the new natural food store, and the manager says, do you have anybody from Nepal? And she said, let me see. And she looked down the list and said, no, I guess not. He says, well, now you do. I'm from Nepal. So now it's 50 different ethnic groups. There's one little town of 14,000.
Sounds like one heck of a kick in place. If you ask me, Pete, we've got another caller on the line. Caller, your name and a question for Pete, please.
Hello, Pete. This is Dari calling from Connecticut. First of all, I just want to say it's an honor to have you with us tonight. You're such an inspiration to so many people, and it's just a pleasure to be able to speak with you. I was wondering, I live in Connecticut, not very far from where you are. Are you going to be doing any concerts or any events in the New York, Connecticut area in the near future?
I'm afraid I don't travel much anymore. I just sing in my hometown or nearby. This coming Sunday, we're having what we call the annual corn festival. And my job is to bring down a great big pot. It holds about 30 or 40 gallons.
Wow.
Build a fire under it, and we get it rolling boil. And then my friend Tom has a basket. He puts 15 ears of corn, no more. And he's got a long pipe, and he lowers that basket wire basket with 15 ears of corn into this boiling water. 1 minute later, he pulls it out and swings it over to a table where it's dumped out, and people put butter and salt on it. And it is so sweet and tender. It doesn't need to be cooked
long. It sounds great.
The corn is
yeah,
right
I'm
out of the farmer's
field. I'm not that far from where you are. I'm just across.
And
you know,
I'll be singing there
Western,
at about
2:30,
I guess.
But anyway, I'll let you go and get back because the show is kind of ending. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you, that basket of corn sounds pretty darn good. I haven't had any dinner yet, Pete. Pete, I'm going to ask you a favor. I really, really, and I'm not kidding, one of my favorite all-time songs, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Could you do a little bit for me?
Well, I'll have to. I can't really sing it very well because my voice is so far gone.
That's okay. If you spoke it, it would be perfect.
I should tell you, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
I should tell you that the idea for the song came from reading a book written by a Russian, Mikhail Sholokhov, was describing the Cossacks galloping off to join the Tsar's army 100 years ago. And they were singing, where are the flowers? The girls have plucked them. Where are the girls? They're all married. Where are the men? They're all in the army. And I said to myself, that would make a good song. And I thought of, I had written it down in my little book, not only those three lines, but a line, long time passing, so that would sing well. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Girls have picked them every one. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn? Who knows where the idea for the song came from originally? Somebody recently uncovered a song in Yiddish which had the same general idea, where are the flowers? Girls have picked them. Where are the girls?
Well, it's an amazing song, an amazing song. You're an amazing hero. You're my hero. I know that you're the hero of so many people that I know. I think our world would not have been the same without you. I want to thank you for being our guest this evening. Next week's guest, on August 21st, folks, we'll be having Mahatma Gandhi's son, Anum Gandhi, on April 21st at 8:30 to 9:30 Eastern Time. Pete, I just want to thank you so much. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we have had the distinct honor and privilege of sharing an hour with Pete Seeger, a folk hero. You are amazing.
Well, thank you for listening to me.
Thank you for being there for us.
Stay well. Keep on.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's all, folks. It's a wrap for the night. See you next week.
This land is mine. From California to New York, from the river.